From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The carbon tax, is it an idea whose time has come? I'm Judy Muller, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Environmentalists have long championed a carbon tax as a way to address climate change. Now it's winning the support of conservative think tanks as well, as a way to address the budget deficit. Today on To the Point, is the carbon tax a smart way to avert both global warming and the fiscal cliff? If so, then why isn't the White House proposing it? And why is Congress so reluctant to consider it? Has Hurricane Sandy changed any minds? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the death of Jenny Rivera, the California-born singer who made her mark in a male-dominated world of Mexican-American music. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
I'm Judy Muller, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with To the Point from PRI. The idea of addressing climate change with a carbon tax is hardly new, but it's suddenly gaining new popularity and from some unusual quarters. The Wall Street Journal recently called the carbon tax crowd a big tent, bringing together deficit hawks, growth mavens, and climate worriers. Later on To the Point, we'll hear from that big tent and ask them why, if this is such a popular idea, it can't get political traction. On Reporter's Notebook, singer Jenny Rivera dies in a plane crash, and millions of fans mourn the loss on both sides of the border. First, this news update. Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi is getting tough on protesters in the run-up to a controversial referendum on a new constitution that's set for Saturday. Morsi has ordered the military to maintain security and protect state institutions, and he's given the army the power to arrest civilians. Earlier, the Egyptian president tried to calm public anger by annulling a decree that gave him enormous powers and by suspending a big sales tax increase. The BBC's John Lyne joins us now from Cairo. Welcome, John.
Yes, good day to you.
What's the reaction to this new order to the army to arrest civilians?
Well, not perhaps as loud as you might expect, but clearly a lot of people are very nervous that this is the slippery slope back to authoritarian rule of the type they just shaken off 60 years of. But it hasn't made a huge amount of difference on the streets so far. There haven't been particularly bigger demonstrations today. We'd already seen the army outside the presidential palace in any case.
Why aren't the police capable of doing this, keeping the order?
Any number of reasons, but they certainly haven't been very capable so far of doing so. They haven't really been reformed and retrained since the Mubarak days, so they're notorious really for their brutality and their corruption. And maybe they just don't have enough numbers, frankly, or enough will to do it at the moment.
Well, the opposition leaders have called for more demonstrations tomorrow. Is that likely to ratchet up this confrontation?
Both sides have called for more demonstrations, both supporters and opponents of President Morsi. So, yes, it could be another very lively day. We're expecting large numbers of people out on the streets, and the temperature is steadily rising as we approach the referendum on Saturday.
Well, now that Morsi's rescinded his decree for absolute power, what is the opposition protesting?
They still are very angry about the referendum on a new constitution, which is going ahead on Saturday. Remember, the constitution was rushed through the Constitutional Assembly and then a referendum announced barely 2 weeks after that. And so they think they're being railroaded into a new constitution, which, of course, you know, is so fundamental to the future of this country more than any individual law. And they feel that constitution is biased against the freedoms they want, against equality, and in favor of Islamic values.
Why is Morsi opposed to just delaying a vote on the Constitution? Wouldn't that calm things down?
Well, it might do, but I think he's got an awful lot to lose. I think he and his movement, the Muslim Brotherhood, feel they're on the verge of getting everything they want, which is an Egypt shaped in their favor, an Egypt with an Islamist tinge to it, if not the full Islamic Republic that some people fear, certainly one leaning towards Islamic values. They've got it very close to their grasp. Most people think they will win the referendum because they're better organized, even if they're not in a majority in this country. And so why give up now? Plus, if he did give up, I think President Morsi's future would be severely in doubt, because he's not just under pressure from the liberals, he's also under pressure from the other side, from the hardliners, people known as Salafists, the really hardline Islamists, who actually think, if anything, he's given too much already to the opposition.
Well, the referendum's on Saturday. Do you think some will boycott? Will it have any kind of value if not enough people turn out?
Well, the thing is that the opposition haven't really made their position clear. They say they reject the legitimacy of the referendum. You might think the logic of that was to boycott, but that word hasn't been used, and they haven't really made clear their position. And I think that may be rather a tactical mistake, because either they should be really organizing themselves as efficiently as possible to turn out the no vote, in which case they might have a slight chance of winning, or they should organize a comprehensive boycott. And we should be going along and filming empty polling stations on Saturday. Well, so far, we've not heard a clear message from them to do either of those.
Getting back to this latest order for the army to arrest civilians if they're disturbing the peace, if they start to arrest civilians en masse, what's the likely outcome of that?
Well, more anger, really, of course. More anger against the army, of course, and against the Muslim Brotherhood. And you have to say, are the army really going to come to the rescue of a Muslim Brotherhood-dominated government? They've, after all, spent decades fighting Islamism. So it is a strange alliance of convenience, you might say. But if things get really sticky, do the army really want to have their name tarnished by imposing an unpopular order, unpopular rule of law from an unpopular government?
What do you predict for Saturday? How do you think it'll look on this?
I'm afraid I've long since given up making predictions here, beyond the fact that it's all a big mess and there's no clear way out of it.
And he keeps trying the carrot and stick approach. First, the suspension of powers and suspension of sales tax, and then coming down and giving this order to the army. It's a little bit of both, isn't it?
Well, the president knows he hasn't really given much the opposition wanted, and he must have known that he wouldn't have satisfied the opposition just by taking away his special powers, because it is now the referendum and the Constitution that is the focus of the anger by the opposition. And if anything, they think this was a bit of a trick by the president, because the main purpose they saw of his special powers was to get through the new Constitution.
Good. Thank you, John Lyne, with the BBC. In a moment, the carbon tax on To the Point.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
I'm Judy Muller, back with To the Point. The carbon tax. The idea has been around for a while, but it's suddenly getting more attention. The reason? The confluence of fiscal cliff negotiations and the superstorm known as Sandy. Here's how a carbon tax would work. It would be imposed not just on gasoline, but on all fossil fuels, from coal used to generate electricity to diesel fuel used to power heavy equipment. And that cost would then be passed on to consumers. Conservative think tanks and even some oil companies are getting behind the idea for economic reasons. The Congressional Research Service recently reported that a modest carbon tax could cut the projected federal deficit in half over the next decade. But there are no signs that politicians in Washington are ready to back a carbon tax. If Congress won't lift a finger on this, is there something the Obama administration could do on its own? The carbon tax was recently described by environmental reporter Elizabeth Culbert and The New Yorker as a fair way to make the driver absorb the cost for his slice of the damage. And she joins us now. Welcome, Elizabeth.
Hi.
First, could you explain how the carbon tax would help the problem of global warming?
Well, there are several different ways to look at it, how's that to slice that cat. But the most obvious way is that if you were paying more for fossil fuels, you would presumably use less of them. So it's sort of a cost price point sort of thing. But you could also say that it would be helping by, as you mentioned, just paying for the damage that you're doing.
So you sort of compare this to like a tax on alcohol and cigarettes. In other words, it's a use tax. You use it, you pay for the damage it causes.
Right, and there are different ways to structure it. You could certainly structure it so that it would, it presumably drive down demand because it would be costly. You could also structure it, so that potentially it wouldn't have much effect on demand. It would just be collecting money to offset the damage. But the damage is probably pretty high, and there are very, very wide estimates, differing estimates of where you'd have to set that tax so that each person, each ton of CO2, people were paying the tax to offset that much damage. So those estimates vary very, very widely.
Well, in your commentary in The New Yorker, you say that it's more likely than ever that the time has come for a carbon tax. So who are the exact players who have signed on to this idea of late?
Well, I would like to point out that I say it's more likely than ever, which is not very likely.
Okay.
But not completely out of the realm of the possible. And I think if you went around Capitol Hill and you asked people, are you signed on to a carbon tax, there have been a couple carbon tax bills that have actually been introduced in Congress, but the number of people who have signed on to them so far is very, very low.
But there are some conservative think tanks, oil companies. I mean, those are strange bedfellows for environmentalists.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you take the tack, if you take the, start from the premise, which many people do who are involved in this world, that you have to put a price on carbon eventually. There's just no other choice. We have a huge global looming disaster, and we have to try to mitigate the damage that we're doing. And the most efficient way to do that is to put a price on carbon and try to both drive down demand, and I should also say make other forms of energy, non-fossil fuel energy, forms of energy, non-carbon releasing forms of energy, more cost competitive, open up all sorts of business opportunities there. That's going to have to come, and the sooner we do it, the more stability there is, the more businesses can plan. These are huge capital investments they make in energy. So if you start from that premise, a lot of companies are saying, well, we would like the certainty that comes with this now.
Well, President Obama, though, has made it clear that he won't be the one to propose a carbon tax. Why is that? And what are the chances that Congress would act, especially with these Tea Party loyalists who've signed a pledge not to vote for any climate tax?
Well, I think that, if you want to take the sort of optimistic view, you'd say this is one of these things that's going to sort of come out of nowhere. It's just going to suddenly magically appear, and maybe no one will take responsibility for it. But even after we do or don't resolve, the fiscal cliff or go off the cliff or avert the cliff, there's a lot of talk that the country needs a major tax overhaul. And this is an idea that seems to be very much sort of out there, even without anyone being attached to it. So we'll see if that means that people, it's just an idea that's, beloved by economists, which it is. It has a lot of support among economists, or whether it actually has some political support, even though so far we're not seeing people willing to step up to the plate and propose it.
Well, this is a good time to bring in Bob Inglis. He's a former GOP congressman from South Carolina, now the executive director of the Energy and Enterprise Initiative. Congressman Inglis, why do you support the carbon tax?
Well, because it's a great way to change what we tax. Right now, we tax income, something we want more of, but we don't tax emissions, which is something we want less of. And so what the case we're making at the Energy and Enterprise Initiative is, if you're a conservative like we are, even if you don't think climate change is real, why wouldn't you want to change what you tax?
Well, how do you persuade members of your party on this issue, and how big a sticking point is it that those Tea Party Republicans have signed a no climate tax pledge?
Well, the thing that's important about that pledge is that it's okay as long as it's revenue neutral. And, of course, that's what we're advocating, is not an increase in the size of government, but rather it just changing what we tax, and a dollar-for-dollar exchange of taxes. So down on some form of income, impose a tax, shift the tax, same dollar-for-dollar tax, onto CO2. And by doing that, you're not growing the government. So it's not violative of that pledge.
All right. Is this a free market solution to climate change in your mind?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. That's why we're, as you just said, economists are for it. And those are economists across the political spectrum, but the ones that obviously we cite the most, because we're, our target audience is conservatives, are people like Greg Mankiw, Glenn Hubbard, Art Laffer. These are conservative economists. And as Art Laffer likes to say, it's a no-brainer. Just change what you tax.
Well, if are conservatives worried that without a carbon tax, the EPA would likely introduce stricter regulations? I mean, which is more onerous to Republicans, government regulation or taxes?
Definitely regulation. In fact, that's a case that we want to make, is that which would you rather, an elegant price signal that gives freedom within the marketplace to substitute into better technology based on a price signal, or do you want some government bureaucrat trying to tell you how many tons of CO2 you can emit on what days? That's a very complicated, that second is a very complicated way to go. The thing that fits with conservatism is the idea of just send the price signal, tell me what it costs, and then watch the free enterprise system innovate far faster than government ever could.
Well, I'd like to bring in Marlo Lewis now. He's with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Welcome, Mr. Lewis.
Hi, Judy.
In the National Journal, you wrote that Washington is not ready for a carbon tax. And after you've been hearing this discussion, why isn't Washington ready for a carbon tax?
Well, there are so many reasons. I mean, if let's begin with the alleged environmental justification, which I know Representative Inglis is not stressing or emphasizing here, but we heard about Hurricane Sandy at the beginning of the program, and that supposedly gives us a new reason to control carbon emissions. If you actually look at climatological data, you find that New York has been pelted by hurricanes going back to as long as there are records, the 17th century. Many of them were much stronger than Sandy, including, for example, a Category 3 storm that hit New York in 1938, which killed 600 people.
Well, if you see Hurricane Sandy as a red herring in this debate, what about the economic benefits of a carbon tax?
Well, I'd like to get to that, but if I could just make one other point.
Okay.
Even if the United States were to eliminate all carbon dioxide emissions tomorrow, which is, of course, not feasible under a carbon tax because you need to emit billions of tons in order to generate revenue. But even if we could go cold turkey on our carbon-based economy, the impact on global temperatures, if you make all the same assumptions that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change makes, is that it would reduce global warming by 0.08 degrees Celsius in 2050 and 0.17 degrees Celsius in 2100. Those are reductions in hypothetical global warming that are so small they would not even be detectable in the noise of normal climate variability. So even if you believe that Hurricane Sandy has a greenhouse fingerprint, that this shows that the climate is getting out of control, these policies would provide zero environmental benefit, zero measurable environmental benefit. All right. Now, let me get
a response to what you're saying here from Elizabeth Colbert, who's written extensively on this. Elizabeth, how do you react to that?
Well, we always get both sides of this argument. On the one hand, it's not a problem, and on the other hand, if we did this, it wouldn't solve the problem. Now, the fact is we have a huge, huge problem. Global temperatures are going up. Whether or not you can directly attribute a storm like Sandy to climate change, there are increasing numbers of weather phenomena, droughts, heat waves, flooding that you can attribute to climate change, and that's only going to get worse. And at this point, I just have to say I think it's ridiculous to have the argument about whether climate change is happening. Now, would a carbon tax solve this? Obviously not. Not as a single country imposing a carbon tax, but as a step towards taking the kinds of steps we need to avoid, you know, absolute global catastrophe, which will affect, you know, all 7 billion people on Earth. It's a first step. And so you have to start with doing the things that can be done. And so just sort of throw up your hands and say, well, there's really nothing we can do. That seems to me to be kind of an unacceptable way to go.
Let me get back to Marlo Lewis once more, the senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. If oil companies are okay with this idea of a carbon tax, why would a group like yours object? Are you worried for consumers paying higher taxes?
Absolutely. Well, I'm worried about consumers paying higher costs for gasoline and for utilities. But also, look, the oil companies here are playing a very cynical game. These same oil companies, like ExxonMobil, has the largest private-held reserves of natural gas in the world. ExxonMobil understands very well that a $20 a ton carbon tax, which is likely where it would start, means only 20 cents a gallon more in your gas tank, but it roughly doubles the price of coal. And if you knock coal out of the energy equation, guess what has to step in to take its place? Natural gas, which already has a cost advantage over coal, which is why most new electric generation in the United States is natural gas fired. So ExxonMobil used to be a company that was in favor of a competitive marketplace. Those good old days are gone. They have now joined the Enrons of the world. They are political capitalists who want to use a carbon tax to rig the market against their competitor, coal. And it's dishonorable, and I wish they weren't doing it, but that's the way I see it.
Well, Bob Inglis, who is executive director of the Energy and Enterprise Initiative, but you once served as the ranking member of the Subcommittee on Energy and Environment in Congress, and you've seen the sausage made, and you're listening to these arguments from Mr. Lewis. How in the world would this get through Congress or even get a start?
Well, first, we've got to build support for it out in the country, because, you know, the leaders will only lead when they send support. So, but of course, very important points just made here. One from Marlo just now. I think that's a great idea for ExxonMobil to make a lot of money on natural gas. I'm for them because what it means is that coal and natural gas then compete on a level playing field, not an unlevel one, a level one. Because what happens is 23,600 people die prematurely each year in the United States because of soot from coal-fired electrical plants, over 3 million lost work days. Those are not accounted in the price of electricity. We pay for those things, all right. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Milton Friedman taught us that in 1975. But it's that we pay through the healthcare system, not at the meter. If we paid at the meter, absolutely, the conversion from coal to natural gas would be accelerated. And that if that means that coal loses out vis-a-vis natural gas, well, that's just the marketplace. And that's what we free enterprise people believe in, accountability and then a fair fight. The fair fight is put all your cost in, eliminate all the subsidies for all the fuels, put all your cost in, and then see what happens.
Right. I want to continue this conversation. We have to take a break. We're talking about the carbon tax, and there's so many people on both sides of the political fence who are in agreement, but yet no political will to get it any traction in Washington. So we'll continue after a brief break on Reporter's Notebook later on. We'll remember Mexican-American pop singer Jenny Rivera. Back in a minute with To the Point from PRI.
If you love discovering new music, check out the KCRW Music Mine. It's KCRW's first iPad app, dedicated entirely to music exploration. The Music Mine takes you into a galaxy of audio, video, and photos of artists from the KCRW playlists, with rolling updates so you can uncover what's next and keep up with the artists you love. Discover, listen, share in the Music Mine, KCRW's free iPad app. More info at kcrw.com.
I'm Judy Muller, in for Warren Olney today on To the Point. We're talking about the carbon tax. Is it one-stop shopping for addressing the problems of climate change and the fiscal cliff? We're having a lively debate on this, and joining us now, Dan Lashoff. He's the director of the National Resources Defense Council's Clean Air Program. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you.
I understand that you agree that a carbon tax is unlikely. So what would you suggest the government do at this point to curb global warming? Is there a better option?
Well, look, I think a carbon tax would be great for the reasons that Elizabeth and Bob have just described. But as Elizabeth herself said, more likely than ever is still very unlikely. So what we at NRDC have focused on is things the president can do with laws that Congress has already passed. Because until we see a change in the position of the Republican House leadership in support of a carbon tax, it's just not going to happen. But the good news is that we found in a report issued last week that there's actually a lot we can do, and that overturning the conventional wisdom that relying on the Clean Air Act has to be expensive and won't make much difference, our report shows that we can actually achieve big reductions at low cost using flexible solutions that drive investments in clean energy to reduce emissions and protect public health, and actually creating benefits that exceed the cost by more than a factor of six. So, you know, Bob earlier said that conservatives prefer a carbon tax to regulation because regulation means a government bureaucrat telling you exactly how much carbon to release on a given day. I guess one could imagine regulations like that, but I actually don't think there are any under the Clean Air Act, and certainly what we're proposing doesn't look like that. What we're proposing is a performance standard that would apply to all fossil fuel generators and would be differentiated from state to state, recognizing that states start with a different generation mix and give them enormous flexibility.
How many power plants are we talking about setting tougher standards?
There's about 1,500 power plants across the country that are big enough to be subject to the kinds of standards that EPA is actually required to issue under the Clean Air Act.
So the president has the legal authority to set tougher standards for those power plants, correct?
He does. He has both the authority and really the responsibility under the Clean Air Act to move forward. He's taken some tentative steps in this direction by proposing standards that would apply only to new power plants. But I think, as everybody's pointed out, nobody's really building new coal plants these days. The real issue is the existing power plants that are pumping out billions of tons, literally over 2 billion tons of CO2 per year, about 40% of the U.S. total. So it's the existing power plants which are the single biggest source of carbon pollution that's driving climate change, and the president can do a lot about it. The proposal that we outlined would reduce emissions from those power plants 26% by 2020, which actually turns out to be about the same as what you'd expect from a carbon tax in the range that people are talking about.
Well, Marla Lewis, a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank, what do you think about the president's legal authority, and what's your take on the EPA regulation versus a carbon tax, for instance?
Well, I think the EPA's regulation of greenhouse gases, which was a power that was awarded to them by the Supreme Court in Massachusetts versus EPA, is actually is an additional authority that was not included in the original Clean Air Act. So the EPA today is effectively legislating climate policy. I think that's constitutionally the job of the people's representatives whenever they have been asked to vote on measures that would actually explicitly authorize to do that. Either the measures have only passed in one chamber, like Waxman-Markey, or have never even gotten to the floor. So I think this is a violation of the separation of powers by judicial activists. So I'm not a big fan of that. I don't really believe that a swap of carbon taxes for carbon regulation is politically feasible. I know that some people talk about a grand bargain of that sort.
Right.
I think in order to lull gullible conservatives and Republicans to coming to the negotiating table. But we have, for example, Henry Waxman himself, Representative Waxman, who said, well, yeah, I kind of like the idea of a carbon tax, but I still want EPA in the game so that it so that by regulation we can guarantee the results we want.
You see that swap as a trap, really.
Okay. Yeah, I think it's a pipe dream, as I think revenue neutrality that Representative Inglis is pushing is also a pipe dream.
Right. Let Bob Inglis get a word in here, because you're mentioning quite a few things. I want to ask Bob Inglis, Executive Director of the Energy and Enterprise Initiative, about that idea of regulation versus a carbon tax, and would there be a swap in there, and would that be a trap for conservatives?
I agree with Marlo that it's not the best way for this to be done. I'm not sure it'd be technically unconstitutional, violation of separation of powers, but I think that it's not the best way to have this happen. We need, in other words, to have the Supreme Court essentially ordering the EPA to do something, and the EPA does it through regulation. That's the way it could go. It's not the best way. The best way is for us to have buy-in across the country. But what we want is real accountability in energy and climate. Now, I happen to think climate is a real problem, but even if you don't think it's a real problem, aren't you still for accountability? Don't you want to eliminate all subsidies for all fuels, attach all costs to all fuels, change what we tax off income, some form of income, on emissions, and then watch the free enterprise system solve this, solve the energy challenge we've got, but also, if you're concerned, as I am, about climate, solve the climate challenge. A key point that's made earlier, Judy, is it's very important that this be also a border-adjustable tax. Just as the VAT is removed on export, imposed on import, I believe that we could see this carbon tax done in that way, that it's removed on export, imposed on import, which would cause countries in the developing world, especially China and India, to see the value in pricing carbon in their own economy. Okay. If they did that, then you get significant global reduction because of an elegant price signal.
Elizabeth Culbert, environmental reporter for The New Yorker. Do you think, I want to get back to leadership here, is Obama leading from behind? Why is he so reluctant to even propose a carbon tax and rather defer to Congress on this?
Well, I was very interested to hear what Congressman Inglis said, which is, you know, leaders only propose things that already have support. So I certainly think there's something a lot to what he's saying, but it also gets to this question of what does leadership mean? If we're simply just, you know, taking a poll and deciding what's popular and proposing it, I don't think that really actually fits most people's definition of leadership. I don't think that anyone would give the president particularly high marks on leadership in the climate area. It's a subject that he mentions occasionally when he gets reelected, when he got nominated back in 2008, he makes some grand pronouncement, and then it sort of just drops off the radar. And if that happens for another 4 years, then I think we're going to be in pretty bad shape by the end of the second term.
Well, Dan Lashoff with the National Resources Defense Council, how do you rate the Obama administration so far? How do environmentalists rate him?
Well, during his first term, President Obama put in place really historic standards that will double the fuel efficiency of new passenger vehicles, cars and light trucks, cutting their carbon emissions from new vehicles in half. And that's the second biggest source of carbon pollution in the United States. If he moves forward in his second term with carbon standards for power plants, the biggest source, then he will have, in fact, cemented a very positive environmental legacy. So I think that the answer hasn't been written yet, but he has the opportunity to use the authority that he has. And I have to say, it's a little weird to hear Marlo Lewis saying that the Supreme Court somehow granted unconstitutional powers to EPA when, by definition, if the Supreme Court says it's constitutional, they interpret the Constitution. So the Supreme Court has said that carbon dioxide is an air pollutant squarely within the definition of the Clean Air Act, and EPA has the responsibility to set those standards. They have that opportunity, and so we're calling on the president to use that authority to set standards, which in fact can be very effective. And, you know, we could debate for a long time whether it's better slightly better or slightly worse than using a carbon tax. I'm focused on what can we get done that actually addresses this critical problem.
Well, Dan, at a time, though, when GOP lawmakers are advocating for abolishing the EPA, are we so divided on climate change and pollution that this Congress isn't likely to pass anything meaningful on global warming? And should we be worried that there's no sense of urgency in Washington?
Well, yes, we should be worried. And this Congress is very unlikely to pass anything helpful on climate change. In fact, in the last 2 years, the House of Representatives passed a dozen bills that would have stripped EPA's authority to regulate carbon emissions. They did everything they could to be unhelpful and to block action. But fortunately, none of those laws, none of those bills made it through the Senate. So the big advantage of using the president's existing authority is you don't have to wait for Congress to get its act together on this issue. All they have to do is stay out of the way and let EPA do its job, which, by the way, is supported by an overwhelming majority of the American people as well.
Well, I'd like to get back to this fact that economists from conservative think tanks, from liberal think tanks, are all in agreement that a carbon tax makes sense. And I keep coming back to this the Congressional Research Service report that says a modest carbon tax would cut the projected federal deficit in half over the next decade. So again, I come back to why isn't everybody on board with this? And I'm hearing the arguments, but I still don't get why there's not more of a groundswell of support. Bob Inglis, what do you think?
Well, I think it's because it causes us to really see the reality as it is, and maybe we don't want to see it. In other words, it would, in fact, cause electricity rates to go up and gasoline prices to go up. A $25 a ton tax on CO2 would cause a 25-cent increase in the price of gasoline and somewhere between a 1 and 2 cent per kilowatt-hour increase in electricity prices. And so you say to a congressional candidate, got a great plan for you. You go out and say, we're going to raise your electricity rates and your gasoline prices and see if you get elected. And, of course, they say, I don't think that'll work for me. But what we need, we got to have a harder conversation and a more honest conversation with American people and say, you're already paying, right? Do you believe in the Tooth Fairy? Do you believe in Santa Claus? Do you believe there's such a thing as a free lunch? Okay, you don't believe any of those things. So let's see it transparently as it is. See that we're paying these costs already just through our healthcare system. So rather than pay through that opaque system, why don't we pay directly and then watch free enterprise innovate very quickly? Because then entrepreneurs could make money selling the new products, the new energy systems, some of which would be distributed, which would bring increase in freedom here and around the world. It's a very exciting opportunity if we can just get through this first question of can you face the accountability, can you face the transparency?
Well, Marla Lewis, do you think people at the pump would object to a driving tax per se? I mean, is this something that people can be persuaded to sacrifice in the name of cutting the deficit or helping climate change?
I don't think so. The reason why cap and trade eventually imploded was that it was exposed as a stealth energy tax. And now some of the same folks who at the time said, oh, we have to propose a carbon tax if you don't want to get cap and trade because you can't beat something with nothing, are now proposing an open, avowed energy tax, Representative Inglis in particular. And the American people, I think, are practical enough to understand that you really can't run a modern economy on biomass, wind turbines, and solar panels, and that if you have a carbon tax, what you are doing is attacking the affordable sources of energy that actually supply most of the energy and virtually all of our transportation fuel, and that can't be good for the economy, especially when it is in a fragile condition. And so Representative Inglis is exactly right. A lot of members of Congress don't think this is a winning strategy for them. And if we recall, back in 2010, 29 Democrats who supported cap and trade lost their seats. And we have a Republican Party now that not only has a no new tax pledge, which virtually all members have signed. But you have a Republican leadership, which, you know, the majority leader, the speaker, the whip, the conference chairman, all these people have now signed a no climate tax pledge. So basically, we are now in a position where the Democrats really have to go first if anyone is going to make this happen, and they all know that that is political peril for them.
Okay, Elizabeth Culbert, I want to come back to you. Do you think that the carbon tax is likely to fall to the same fate as cap and trade? Is this just a non-starter?
Well, I think that you've raised, you know, a really interesting question, and all the responses have sort of have gotten to that, which is, okay, look, here is a tax that people, economists on both sides of the aisle say makes sense. We would shift, as Congressman Angus said at the top of the show, we would shift from taxing income, something, you know, that has, you know, that we want to generate more of, to taxing emissions, something we want to generate less of. This is a no-brainer on some level, but we can't muster the political. Meanwhile, we have this overwhelming, you know, environmental problem that we need to either deal with or we won't deal with. We will deal with it by not dealing with it, in which case we will really, really seriously pay. The costs of not doing anything are very, very high, I guarantee you. So
okay.
We have all this argument for doing it, and yet we can all sit here, the four of us, the one thing maybe the four of us can agree on is that this is very, very unlikely. So there's something wrong with the political system in which this is the case.
Okay. Well, thank you, all of you, for joining in this discussion. Elizabeth Culbert, environmental reporter for The New Yorker, Bob Inglis, executive director of the Energy and Enterprise Initiative, Marlo Lewis of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and Dan Lashoff with the National Resource Defense Council. To her millions of fans, she was known simply as Jenny. Jenny Rivera died Sunday in a plane crash in northern Mexico. The 43-year-old singer had an enormous impact on the Mexican-American music scene, and we'll have more in a moment on To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_KCRW.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
I'm Judy Muller, sitting in for Warren Olney, back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. That's the voice of Jenny Rivera. The 43-year-old singer and actress was killed in a plane crash in northern Mexico on Sunday. Born in California, she became a superstar in the male-dominated genre of banda music. Joining us now, Gustavo Arellano, editor of the OC Weekly and a KCRW contributor. Welcome, Gustavo.
Hola.
There are a lot of gringos, myself included, who did not know about Jenny Rivera's fame until the news of her death was reported. Why is that?
Well, mostly because of the pathetic mainstream media coverage that we have across the United States, but especially here in Southern California. Here you have Jenny Rivera, somebody who has sold millions of albums, somebody who had two television shows on the air, somebody who had, I mean, it's the classic, she wasn't an immigrant, she was born in Long Beach, but it's that classic, you know, up from your bootstrap story. She had her own real estate agency, her own cosmetics line, and more importantly, she was just an awesome, wonderful personality. But because she was a Mexican woman, it seemed that the mainstream media never really cared about it until finally they see that, a singer passes away, then they start seeing all the grief of her fans. Oh, wow, it's a story after she passed away. So I think this is more of an indictment, not of the gabachos out there, because you guys have to rely on the New York Times and the LA Times for your knowledge of the rest of the world. But really, it's on those institutions. It's their problem.
Well, do you think it was because the stories she sings are so unique to the Mexican-American culture?
Not at all. I mean, those are universal, the themes that she talked about, universal themes, themes of partying, themes of female empowerment, and later on toward her career, themes against domestic violence. I mean, these were topics that our own modern-day singers won't even touch with a 10-foot pole. So just on a purely rational musical level, in terms of the artistry that she was doing, she was really remarkable. It just so happened, the story then becomes, it so happened to be in Mexican music, specifically banda sinaloense. That's what, that's a notoriously macho genre. So not only do you have this amazing musician, but she's doing it in a genre that would have never expected any woman to do it, let alone somebody like her, let alone a Mexican-American woman.
Well, she went through a lot in her life, teen pregnancy, divorce, her family problems, and she sang about all of those things. And is that part of the appeal, is that everybody could relate, especially women?
Oh, of course. I mean, she became, her nickname was La Diva de la Banda, the diva of banda music. And it was not only for her great voice, it was not only for her outgoing personality, but because she talked about issues that women are never supposed to talk about. We're not even talking here Mexican women. We're just talking about women, period. You're not supposed to talk about domestic abuse. You're not supposed to talk about your own failings, your own misgivings. You're supposed to be this, you know, this tart. You're supposed to talk about, you know, just be somebody cute like Taylor Swift or Rihanna or somebody like that. And then to do it in Mexican regional music. Historically, with Mexico regional music, you had, you know, people like Lola Beltran, Lucha Villa, you know, wonderful women, still beloved in Mexico, but they just sang the songs that they were supposed to sing, that they were always a victim. They were always the one whose hearts were broken. Jenny, on the other hand, she said, yes, I've had my heart broken, but you know what? I also broke hearts as well. You know what? I was a girl. I was a party girl, and I loved to party. And you know what? I was also a proud mother, a proud woman. And if you don't like me like that, well, too bad, because that's who I am. And that's just, again, for any artist, it's revolutionary. For a Mexican woman to do that in Mexican regional music, it was unheard of.
Right. Did she? She sang. I know we have one clip of her singing in English, covering a Freddie Fender song.
Wasted days and wasted nights.
I gotta say, Gustavia, now I'm into it. Okay, so do you think that she'd done more English language songs that she would have been more of a crossover artist?
That's the thing. She did do those English songs. She did Wasted Days and Wasted Nights, a wonderful Freddie Fender song. She did a cover of Angel Baby, the old song by Rosie and the Originals. She did her own version of I Will Survive. And more importantly, though, her television shows that she was doing, I mean, Anyone who bothered to check in with her knew that she spoke fluent English. She was born here, for crying out loud. Anyone who ever bothered to check in knew that the music that she grew up with, as she admitted, I had the chance of interviewing her twice at length, in 2003 for the OC Weekly and 2009 for Latina Magazine, and both times she freely admitted the first music that she was listening to was hip-hop. She was born in Long Beach, for crying out loud, you know, at a time where hip-hop music was really big. She always played around with that music, but for mainstream media reporters, they see, okay, Latina surname, singing in Mexico, you know, singing Mexican regional music. There's no way on earth she probably even knows English, so why should we even bother connecting with her in the first place? And it's something that did frustrate her, but she was onto it. The great thing about Jenny, and again, going back to why people loved her so much, is that she always had a plan for herself. And what's so upsetting for me is that just last week, ABC, the network, they announced that they were going to do a sitcom with Jenny, starring her, about her life. And, you know, America was just about to realize what a wonderful, awesome person she was. And it's a tragedy that now we just have to reflect on her career and her life.
Do you think there will be younger women who will pick up that her mantle and for us gringos to learn about before, you know, any more time goes by?
There was nobody like her, and I don't think there ever will be anyone like her, because not only do you have to have the talent, that's hard enough. Not only do you have to have the ambition, that's hard enough as well, but you have to have that drive. And the great thing about Jenny and my interactions with her, like whenever I talked to her, she had all these plans. I'm going to have my own real estate company. I'm going to have my own line of beauty salons. I'm going to have my own cosmetics. I'm going to be a television producer. Everyone's always going to brag about what they're going to do, but she did them all. And, you know, who knows how far she would have gone. She could have been the queen of all media, not just for Latinos, but even here for everyone in the United States.
So if there's a message you would impart to the mainstream media about covering artists like this, what would it be?
Pay attention to the people who live in your communities. Don't pay attention necessarily to who you think reads you. Pay attention to your actual community. If anybody had paid attention at all to the Latinos who live in Southern California, a lot of us who speak English, by the way, if not the majority, you would have known the huge story that she was. But since, again, Latinos like myself, you know, we're always relegated to being tokens or to being, you know, these nice little playthings that get brought out on Cinco de Mayo or Mexican Independence Day, the rest of the year we're only covered as, you know, as gang members, as, you know, as what the media has covered us for God knows how long. And the LA Times and other publications, they always, you know, rail about, oh, we're so wonderful, we're diversifying. We've been hearing that same song for 25 years, and I think this is the ultimate indictment.
Well, what would you say is your lasting memory of her? You interviewed her twice.
Again, just what a determined woman she was. I mean, she was great. You know, in my OC Weekly story, I was rereading it just because I hadn't read in a while. And actually, the last part of the interview was I asked her, so when you pass away, heaven forbid, how are people going to remember you? And her response was, people are going to remember me as a woman who was always ultimately herself. She was somebody who had her plans and went out and got them and ultimately just stuck by being herself. So this was a, you know, it's one of those unique American stories. And, you know, hopefully people realize it. This isn't a Mexican story. It's not even a Mexican-American story. It's an American story, plain and simple.
There was an outpouring from the fans yesterday and on Spanish-speaking stations. You know, what are fans doing to remember her?
Well, right now, I think we're waiting for whatever public remembrance there is going to be about her. The local stations here, La Que Buena and La Raza, 105.5 Que Buena, 97.9 La Raza, they're playing bumper-to-bumper Jenny Rivera music. They're playing
right.
clips from her career, like, you know, her talking about her career. There's a lot of makeshift memorials right now in Plaza Linwood, outside the Fonovisa Studios,
okay.
I believe, in Burbank.
Well,
there's a lot of commemoration. Of course, on Facebook, forget it.
Right. Okay. Well, thank you, Gustavo Arellano, editor of the OC Weekly and a contributor to KCRW. Thanks for talking to us today.
Gracias.
Today's program was produced by Evan George, Christian Bordahl, and Sonia Geis. The technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Judy Muller, singing in for Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.